solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
One of the things I didn't want to do was to, in the end of a chapter, have these are the three lessons from this book. You have to. Quite the opposite. What I wanted to do was have people relate to my story and see a piece of themselves in the story. Much like I would, if you told me your story, I'd probably see a piece of myself in that story. And then you take out whatever lessons, as if by osmosis, not by
injection.
Welcome to the 43rd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach and I work with leaders during high-stakes transitions, whether it's related to an organization or the leader's career. I feel just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win, in the context of their strategy. We all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. I work with leaders to address those two questions, especially during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I like to get to the bottom of how people have addressed this question at various points in their journey. The next guest on the podcast is Rajat Gupta, former head of McKinsey Worldwide, who later was accused and convicted of insider trading and spent 2 years in jail. He just launched the book Mind Without Fear, published by Juggernaut. I've realized that when you take the name Rajat Gupta, it evokes different emotions in different people. As a matter of fact, I went through a phase of reflection to consider if I should interview him for the podcast. At that time, I spoke to a few people at McKinsey, and here's a representative sample of what I heard from several of them.
Rajat Gupta, who was the managing director of McKinsey, and I spent a lot of time with building ISB, and of course, Rajat got into quite a bit of trouble. But, you know, as a person, he's been amazingly inspiring, and particularly with all the troubles he went through with his case and then being in jail and out of it. So I really admire Rajat, have always admired him for his ability to think big and yet retain a certain humility. And a certain commitment to making other people successful. So I stay very close to him, and he's one of clearly my heroes, in spite of everything that has happened and to him and for him.
This clip you just listened to was from Pramod Sinha, who was a director at McKinsey, the first dean at ISB, and one of the founders of Ashoka University, Vedika Scholars for Women, and several other institutions. Several other colleagues in McKinsey and outside had similar things to say about Rajat. I was also reminded of a scene from the movie Sully, which is about the pilot Sully Sullenberger, whose plane suffered a bird hit, and he miraculously landed the plane on the Hudson and saved all the lives on board. The insurance company comes after him and tries him in the courts. As he prepares for his trial, he tells his co-pilot in one of the scenes, I quote, "You know, I've delivered 1 million passengers over the last 40 years, but I will be judged on 208 seconds. When I look at Rajat's journey, it's very similar to that. This podcast is about learning from people's journeys and how they thought about choices and personal growth at various points in time. I also realize that what I'm creating is developmental content and not entertainment. So if you want a deep dive into the nuts and bolts of the case and his association with Rajarajaratnam, this is not the place where you'll find it. But if you want a glimpse into his journey at McKinsey and his reflections on life given what he's gone through in the last few years, you might walk away with some insights that might provoke your thinking. Without further ado, let's jump into the conversation with Rajat Gupta. Rajat, thank you so much for making the time to come on this podcast.
You're welcome.
Real privilege to talk to, as a McKinsey alumnus, real privilege to talk to somebody who headed McKinsey for 3 terms. So thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
Rajat, you've just launched the book, Mind Without Fear. I wanted to actually pick up from the last line of the book. And I quote, you write, "The question on my mind is, how should I complete this life with tranquility and with grace?" As you take stock now, how do you think about what matters in life? And how do you plan to spend your time in the coming years? And in what ways has it shifted, let's say, between 2008 and 2016?
Well, you know, I have, of course, learned a lot of lessons going through this experience. And even more than that, it has taught me what is important in life in many different ways. Then I always had some beliefs about what is important in life. Like, for example, basically always try to do the right things and with the right intentions and work your best you can, and then don't worry about the results. This has been a kind of personal philosophy, which is the philosophy of Karma Yoga. Not that you can always perfect it, but at least it's an aspiration how you work. But through this time period, I think there were a few other things that have come to me. One of the things I never quite realized what lay behind it. My father used to always say, "You can't always control what happens to you, but you can control how you react to it." And just, you know, reacting to adversity with grace, with gratitude, with humility, with you know, respect for others, with lack of anger, is very important. And it gives you more inner peace and the ability to deal with whatever comes your way. I also learned a number of lessons about, you know, how do you make sure that you are a great lesson in equanimity? How do you kind of take the ups and downs, the so-called when you're happy or very sad? I mean, how do you take all that pretty much in an even tempered way? And you know, life is just a set of experiences. It's nothing is good or bad. It's just how you make out of what you make of it. So these are some of the things that, you know, come to you as you go through the type of things that I went through.
And maybe more tactically, Rajat, as you think about your pie chart of time looking ahead, just in your head, how do you plan to spend time? What sorts of things do you think are going to be filling up time for you in the coming years?
I think it would be a more or less a continuum of what I was doing, say, from late 90s onwards. Even though I was managing partner of McKinsey, I spent a lot of time on philanthropic causes, primarily in education and health, global health. I did a lot, you know. In the late 90s, I worked on the initiative to start the Indian School of Business. I also worked to do something in public health in India, which is called the Public Health Foundation. And I did a whole bunch of things in global health. So what I'm saying there is that it was a journey to give back to society. I always felt that business works with the permission of society. It has an obligation to give back to society. It actually has an obligation, is well positioned because of the skills you develop as a business leader, that you apply those skills in solving actually much harder problems than business strategy or organization. You work hard on solving societal issues that are quite intractable, but they need the type of skills business can bring. So I always believed in that. I believed in a partnership between government, civil society, and business to bring all their respective strengths together to solve a problem. So I've been doing that for some time now, perhaps, certainly 20 years, maybe 25. And this whole episode, in a way, interrupted that for, let's say, 6-7 years. And I want to just resume that journey. I would say that what would happen is that I have now much less interest in any commercial ventures of any kind. I'm 70 years old. I don't think it's necessarily needed after a, 45-year business career. So I devote most of my time to philanthropic things and some time to myself and with my daughters, granddaughters, spending time with family and taking it a little easy. I have a bucket list of places I should go before I die. So, things like that. And perhaps learning something completely new. It won't be related to business or which I don't know what it is, but something will emerge.
Very interesting. You speak about family, Rajat, and in the book you talk at length about your relationship with your father and your daughters. How do you think about transmitting values from one generation to another? You talk about your family visiting you every weekend when you were in jail. What's been your narrative with your daughters as they were growing up? And in what ways has that changed over the last few years?
I talk extensively about my dialogue with my father, who was a very busy journalist. So when I was growing up, I didn't see a lot of him. In some ways, I would say that I had a similar relation. As head of McKinsey, you travel all around the world. You don't necessarily have that much time for your own family. I tried to get back home every weekend and take them on trips, but the interactions by necessity curtailed to certain, curtailed because of travel.
Sure.
So, but I have a very close relationship with my daughters. I mean, even when they were growing up, we spent a lot of time together. I enjoyed taking part in their academic curriculum and coaching them, and I enjoyed playing games with them and so on and so forth. And I still do that today. I mean, so we have a very close relationship in general. And I'm there to counsel them. Two of my daughters are artists, so it's out of my depth in terms of what I can tell them about their professional careers. But in terms of life discussions, sure. I mean, we are a very close family, and lots of that happens.
And one of the things I picked up in the book, you talk about the choice not to play golf. It sort of reminded me of something I read in a book by Clay Christensen of Harvard, where he would say that, he had to choose between attending the church on Sunday versus playing basketball with his friends. And he said, as a rule, I don't want to miss church. So I was just curious.
Well, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I mean, it's not that you can play golf as well as spend time with your family. It's not either or. I mean, it's simply that I traveled a lot, and golf is a very time-consuming game. So if you then played golf in the weekends, I would be really missing out. So whenever I was home, I devoted much of the time with the kids.
Got it. One of the other pieces that got my attention in the book, Rajat, is your friend Atul Kanagat. You talk about him creating 8 laws of Rajat Gupta and framing it somewhere.
His wife had a big role to play in that too. I mean, both of them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I was just wondering, given your journey, if one were to ask you at this point in time, 8 laws for highly successful people, what sorts of things would you put in there?
I don't think there is a general statement like that, right? If you look at highly successful people, firstly, you have to figure out what you mean by highly successful people. But you see all kinds of styles and all kinds of profiles. You as a high-level executive coach must know that yourself, that different profiles and different leadership styles are all successful. I mean, so there is no one size fits all, no one formula. In general, throughout the book, I at least want to give insight into my own leadership style and what I did and didn't do. I don't profess that's the universal answer. So in some ways, I don't want to necessarily answer your question because I don't think... But I'm sure there are some broad principles that are very important. It's not always the same for everybody, but you know, I always felt working through teams and caring for people and making them successful was a very important ingredient of leadership. Generally, I'm a believer in lead from behind, give people responsibility, but hold a safety net under them and let them succeed. Give them the entrepreneurial space to rise and to the challenge and make contributions. That's, I believe, the best way to get the maximum potential out of your team. So there are these common threads, but I can't, you would have seen that in the book, one of the things I didn't want to do was to, in the end of a chapter, have these are the three lessons from this book. You have to, quite the opposite. What I wanted to do was have people relate to my story and see a piece of themselves in the story. Much like I would, if you told me your story, I'd probably see a piece of myself in that story. And then you take out whatever lessons, as if by osmosis, not by
injection.
Yeah,
I hear you. Fair enough, Rajat. Point well taken. But you spoke about your leadership style, and in the book you also talk about the Swami Vivekananda style and the Napoleon style, right? In terms of being democratic and being decisive. In your, and I specifically ask this in the context of a firm like McKinsey, where you have several intelligent, thoughtful, opinionated partners at the top. How have you thought about that spectrum, and in what sorts of situations have you worked at different points in that spectrum?
Well, as you know, I think, if I may say so, McKinsey has an extraordinary talent. As if you just assess it in terms of pure business, there is no other institution in the world which has more CEOs amongst their alumni. There's none, not even close. So that means that there is, firstly, that they had enormous raw talent. They also learned a lot during their time in McKinsey. And they developed a good, and perhaps unique to each one of them separately, leadership style that worked for them and for the... But in McKinsey itself, leading McKinsey, because of the characteristics of their very highly talented people with their own points of view, and we really work as a partnership, what that means is that the job of the managing partner is really a sort of first amongst equals rather than, here I'm the leader, I'll show you the way and you follow me. You have to, your main responsibility is to understand the aspirations of your partners and to then nudge it in a particular way, influence it, but not try to dictate it. Of course, you have tremendous influence because in a firm like McKinsey, as a managing director, you make all the appointments. So you can be selective on who you choose for leadership positions and as a result influence the direction. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you don't have unchecked powers, nor do you have complete freedom. It's very democratic. All major decisions are made in a democratic fashion. So in that sense, it's a very high contact sport. Leadership in McKinsey is like, you know, you have to be there. You have to, you know, have intense dialogues with your fellow partners. You have to understand them. You have to often visit them in their own home turf. You know, as a McKinsey director, you don't come, okay, I want to see you, come and visit me in my ivory tower. It doesn't work like that. And shouldn't work like that. So, you know, it's a particular style of leadership. I'm not sure that that is relevant for all companies. Yeah. But more and more, if you have a talented team, that works well. When you want the team to have, to rise to the occasion and perform to their best, then you must behave like a collaborative partnership.
Got it. Going back to that stint when you were heading McKinsey, Rajat, what sorts of things, how did you spend your time and attention? And I guess in a way you had three terms. So I'm curious about, as a leader, if you could talk about just if you've got partners, capable partners driving their own ship, therefore, what's the role of the leader and what sorts of things does he or she spend time on to move the firm forward?
So I was at a fairly unique time. I became managing partner, and I was the first managing partner who joined the firm after Marvin Bauer retired. Okay. So Marvin Bauer was the de facto founder of the firm and shaped the values of the firm very much. And most of the all of the managing directors before me were mentored by Marvin. Now, Marvin was still active when I joined the firm, but had formally retired. And, you know, he used to come to the office, but basically he had...
You talk about him showing up as Santa Claus.
Yeah, he showed up in many, many things. But that's an interesting, you know, it's like a real transition in the firm where you didn't grow up under the founder, but you came after that. I was also... 45 when I got elected, and was really a transition to the next generation of firm leaders. I was also the first non-American to be elected managing partner. I was also the first managing partner to be elected outside New York. I mean, I was the Chicago office manager when I got elected. So all of that, you know, had a kind of a, I don't know. It was sort of change in a way that was, and I decided not to move to New York. I decided to stay in Chicago. So here was the, you know, supposedly the center of the firm was New York. It clearly said, no, not really. New York is just another office, and there are many offices. So there were a lot of signals of change in my first term as managing director. I undertook a strategy project for the firm, which most managing directors do. But I had thought about it in a very different way. I thought about it as a process. You know, normally when you do a strategy, you pick maybe a task force of 10, 15 partners and you say, go and think about it for 6 months and do your analysis, just like a client strategy team, and you come back. And I felt that was not the right process for us, and that what we should be doing is to involve a very large number of people and a very large number of principals, which is the junior partners, so that they could deliberate on the direction they want to take their firm, because they were future leaders of the firm. And also that we would have a very involved process, which eventually took about 2 years. So it was a long process where you have a process of dialogue amongst partners shaped by this very large team that did that. And we would come together and deliberate and came out of that sort of directional themes for the firm. It was a very successful process, you know, because by the time we got to the end of it, about half of it was already implemented because people thought the idea was good. We would go and do something and there's still the process. It wasn't like, here's the strategy report, you know. So the first term was consumed by that in addition to the normal activities that a managing director does, which is, you know, make appointments, visit offices, visit clients. The other thing I did was very much everywhere I went, I visited clients. I mean, I talked to clients. I never actually gave up client service. Because one of the things I always said this to the client service firm. So even as a managing partner, I was introducing clients, helping in client teams and so on, because I thought I must keep a hand in client service. The second term was consumed by governance issues. Now, the firm was growing very fast. It was now had a global footprint. Previously, it was more a North American, European firm with some offices. We had Tokyo office and we had Hong Kong office and something. But basically, we rapidly opened another 20 or so offices in around the world. And I believe that we should have a global footprint, much like our clients were getting global footprints. So in order to serve them effectively, we should have a global footprint ourselves, or perhaps even a more extensive one. Otherwise, how would we serve them? So, but the second term, the time to came was, you know, the firm was becoming larger and larger. How do we change the governance of the firm to maintain the spirit of partnership and the principles behind partnership and yet be prepared for a much more global, much larger firm? So I set up a governance task force, which was a very different kind of. It was more senior people, but not the most senior people. So these were not the senior directors, but the directors who were likely the next leadership group in the firm. People who would be succeeding me and so on. So I gathered a group of 20 very high-talented junior directors who formed this task force. And we created a set of governance recommendations. I won't go into all of them, but basically it was designed to, you know, certain principles of governance we wanted to enshrine, like rotation. You know, it had become a little bit static. You know, there were, if you became an office manager or head of an office, you stayed there for a very long time.
It's like tenure.
Yeah, like that. And we said, no, I mean, you know, every 5-6 years, we must change the leadership of an office. And in fact, the practice leaders, we said every 3 or 4 years, you should change. And so rotation became part of one of the principles. There were many such principles, governance principles we articulated. In fact, one of the changes I wanted to do was to also have a rotation on managing director. I was 45 when I could do 5 terms, 15 years. That's way too long. You know, if I haven't done what I wanted to do in, you know, 7 to 10 years, I will never be able to do it. So it didn't make any sense to me that. So I imposed a term limit of 3 terms for the managing partner. The board also would be rotating and so on. So that is one of the governance things. But the other was to make, another important one was to make the industry axis and the functional practice axis also as strong as the geographic axis. Mm-hmm. McKinsey First was a very geographically oriented firm. You're head of this office, that office, etc. Now, not only were head of offices important, but head of industries was important, and head of functions like operations or IT, etc. And that created a more complex form because this is sort of a three-dimensional matrix. But at the same time, it was able to better meet the needs of our clients. So there were, I don't want to go through all points, but the second term was pretty much consumed by governance changes and implementing them and so on. The third term, the the main issue there was really the dot-com bubble had burst. And it was, as you articulated a little bit earlier to me, it was a time when it was very tough. We were growing fast and suddenly the music stopped. And we had, normally McKinsey used to get about, overall about two-thirds of the offers generally we made. So in
order from a hiring perspective.
From a hiring perspective. So in order to hire about 1,800 to 2,000 consultants a year, which we did at that time, we would make about 2,700 offers. And so we made 2,700 offers and the demand dropped and the acceptance rates went up to over 90%, almost 100%. So we got 2,600 people instead of getting. Yeah, no, it was quite amazing. You know, this was true of most consultant firms. They managed it differently than we did. We accepted everybody and created internal projects to keep them busy and so on. And when the economy then took off, we had a bench that was stronger than anybody else because we had taken them all in and not. Anyway, so the third term was pretty much consumed by dealing with post-bubble crisis in a way, managing the firm through those times.
Got it.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I find it interesting that when one moves from a CXO role to a CEO role, one needs to start focusing much more on the balance sheet without losing sight of the P&L. In the first term, Rajat talks about evolving the strategy at McKinsey by involving a large number of junior partners around the world over a prolonged period of time. He sees this as a change opportunity and not just as a strategy development exercise. In the second term, he talks about building structures and governance processes that would set the firm up for the future and speaks about involving junior directors, the future leaders of the firm, in doing so. In the last term, he speaks about taking a cross-cycle view by not firing the talent immediately after the dot-com crash and investing in them, thereby having the capacity to go after the market when the cycle turned. It's interesting to see how there's a long-term institution-building mindset that's embedded in each of the things that Rajat says in the way he went about embarking on each initiative during his three terms. If you find the podcast content purposeful, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or any of the other podcast platforms where you access your content. This is available on Apple, Google, Spotify, Savan, and most other podcast platforms. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rajat Gupta.
Maybe going back a couple of transitions, Rajat, in your journey, I just found it fascinating the context in which you were elected to head Scandinavia and then to head Chicago. So especially in a context like McKinsey where you need to build trust at the highest levels, talk to us a little bit about your approach in that transition when you were parachuted is possibly the wrong term, when you were sent to Scandinavia to head it. The reason I bring up these two markets is I got a sense one is very entrepreneurial, where there's a huge market, and Chicago being a very developed market with established relationships. So talk to us a little bit about what you've learned about building trust at the highest level when you come in those markets.
Yeah, just a minor correction. I didn't go there to lead the Scandinavian office.
So you were there and you were promoted.
I was there already. And we had an unfortunate incident. The head of the office got sick. And so I was appointed. I was a principal. I think it was the only office in the firm that was headed up by a principal, which is a junior partner. And there were three of us, very young partners, and we decided we were going to show the firm that we could lead an office, you know. And I developed a sort of strong collective leadership model, involved everybody, even non-partners, into the decision-making, the senior project managers and so on. And we decided to have a preemptive strategy and make sure that we dominated the Scandinavian client base. So first thing we did is we sort of cornered the supply. So we would hire every qualified Scandinavian that was graduating out of business schools in US and Europe and everywhere. And we also were very strong in competitive negotiations. I mean, generally in the firm, there was a practice of you never, you know, it's like McKinsey, you come to McKinsey, and, you know, we were much more aggressive, and we were within mind sort of saying, if you have any questions, because our fees were generally higher than everybody else, and people were coming in from London and Germany, etc. So we would resist that they could gain a foothold. And we would win these competitions. And literally for 10 years, there was nobody else who could open an office because they couldn't find the talent and they didn't win any, you know, marquee assignments. So that was the strategy. It became very successful and it grew. The McKinsey office in Scandinavia grew from like 20 people in the, you know, early 80s to 160 people. I left in 1986. So it had a dramatic growth and we did very well. Chicago, as you said, it was a very different market. It was a mature office. That's where McKinsey started in the late 20s. But Chicago had more, the city that had more client headquarters, corporate headquarters than any others except New York. So that was the big market. It was a relatively small office. It was 60 people, between 50 and 60 professionals, and the opportunity was huge. So while it was a mature office, it was a relatively small office. And so the challenge there was very different. There were many senior partners and so on. And there the idea really was to... And I brought some of the same internal processes, collaborative processes, trying to help each other solve problems, and a big external reach. The key issue there was to actually develop more clients. And we were able to do that by not only, you know, initially people said we have too many partners there, it's too top heavy. In fact, I invited more partners to join in and built the critical mass to go and proactively engage with clients we didn't serve. And there were many, many. So that office also did extremely well and grew from like 60 professionals to, you know, almost 200 within a very short period of time.
Got it. Persisting with the transition, Rajat, since you've sort of led in different markets, culturally different markets, anything to be said about getting the cultural piece around the transition right, especially given India, Scandinavia, US, all these are very different cultures? What have you learned about culturally assimilating / building trust at the highest level?
Yeah, the first thing to say is that the approach that McKinsey takes in solving problems or developing clients is fairly uniform across. It's not that we very much change our values or change our approach. So in some ways, it is the same. In many other ways, there are differences. I mean, differences, there are probably as many differences within any country in terms of type of clients than they're actually between different countries. Because our client base is basically the Fortune 500 of the world, right? So they're all global companies, or most of them are global companies with people, the senior executives are global business executives. They are exposed to the world. They have opportunities everywhere. So the mindset is in many ways similar. Their aspirations are similar. Their needs are also similar, you know, in terms of, you know, what is important. Scandinavia had a disproportionate number of global leaders you know, whether it's the Ericssons or the Electrolux or the Atlas Copcos or, you know, Statoils or you name it, they're leadership companies in Scandinavia. And so they were not much unlike sort of large U.S. multinationals. I also observed that there are different styles between very successful McKinsey directors in developing clients, very different styles. They all work in the same marketplace, but very different styles.
Give us a couple of examples, maybe just to illustrate the point.
For example, there are directors who are don't have any great bedside manner or don't have great relationship skills, but they are primarily driven by sort of the professional skill they bring to the table, and in fact are sometimes rather harsh and rather, I would say, don't have soft skills, but yet they're very successful. You named a couple of directors before, the contrast, you can see them there in terms of how two very successful directors had a very different styles. So I don't think there is anything unique in that. My personal style, which I think worked across these environments, had to do with having a dialogue with a client and the perspectives, issues they're facing, being a very astute listener, rather than saying, you know, here's a theory that I want to and it must apply. I'm not, you know, I don't have a hammer and looking for a nail to nail down somewhere. I mean, it's more to let's really understand what the client needs. And also, not to push very hard. You know, it's like you have to wait for the right time when the client is ready. You know, I have so many different experiences. I met the CEO of Walmart in China one time. We were on the same board. And I said, I'd like to come and see you. They were not a client of ours. So he said, yeah, you can come, but don't expect any work. We don't like consultants. We don't use consultants. So I said, okay, but I'd like to come anyway. So I went all the way to Bentonville, which is not an easy place to get to. And we spent an hour talking about various business issues and what. And the hour finished, and I said to him, I hope the time was useful. If you learned something from this, then let's schedule another hour in 3 months' time, you know, and I'll think about what you've told me and I'll have some thoughts and ideas and so on. He said, yeah, I found it useful. Sure. So I went on these every 2-3 month meetings for like 3 years. There was no work. And then one day I get a call from him and he says, I have an assignment I want you to do. And it was not competitive. It was nothing. Walmart is known for its very competitive vendor relations and this. Nothing. And I had similar experiences in many clients, which is what you just have to wait for the right time.
And maybe just sticking with that example, Rajat, how do you draw the distinction between somebody trusting Rajat Gupta, the person, and trusting McKinsey, the institution? How have you thought about, in a lot of these situations, people trust the individual sometimes and expect that individual to be heavily involved in something, but as a managing partner, time is finite. So how have you thought about making that distinction and positioning the firm as well as a leader?
No, you know, it's clearly when you have a dialogue with a client, one of the things you have to communicate to them is what McKinsey is and what the talent pool and what the capabilities of the firm are. And that we are able to deliver. In the strategy project, there was a thing that came out called 100% Cube. The notion was simply that we would provide the best of our capabilities along all these lines: client understanding in the marketplace, industry knowledge, functional knowledge, and we'd be able to deliver that to a client wherever the talent existed in the firm. And it was not just limited to that office, because the firm was a worldwide partnership, not just a parochial setup. So you have to, along the way, convince them of that. But it is fundamentally based on a trust-based relationship between you and the CEO that you're serving.
And maybe moving to your journey, Rajat, how have you thought about your development as a leader? If you look at your journey to Scandinavia, to Chicago, to leading the firm, what's been your approach to scaling up your muscle as a leader?
Well, I mean, it was perhaps mostly by necessity and perhaps different needs in different times of my career and so on. As you would expect, I graduated in IIT and then went to HBS, and what I discovered in my early days that my particular skill, and I developed it well, was that I was a good problem solver. And, that's the fundamental foundation block for being a consultant. So I invested a lot in becoming a better and better problem solver. I was a reasonably good, I dealt with people well, so a reasonably good project manager when that was. But I was not particularly good at client relations or client development. And it's, of course, somewhat of a learned skill that you actually learn through mentorship of others, right? And they teach you how to do it and so on, and you observe them doing it and you learn from it. And that, I had some good teachers in the New York office where I was growing up. But still, I was not anywhere as good as was clearly evident when I went to Scandinavia. I observed two of my partners there were amongst the three partners that remained after this head of the office had to leave, who was a very good client developer. And initially, I worked with him and learned a lot. Two out of the other three, including me, that were then leading the office, were extraordinarily good client developers and introducers. And I learned a lot from them, observing them as to how they do it. And because there was nobody else in New York, there were many senior directors who, negotiated with the clients, etc., and you executed the assignment. But in Scandinavia, there was nobody like that. So you had by necessity to go and develop clients. And I always say, I feel like there's a combination. The best development model is actually a combination of mentorship, apprenticeship, and entrepreneurial space, where you have a vacuum that you have to rise up to. And with a safety net, if you start failing, somebody's there to. And Scandinavia was that, there was a vacuum with the three young partners, and we had to keep many people busy and grow the office and all that stuff. And I learned entrepreneurial skills in Scandinavia. I would say I was not a very good entrepreneur, nor a very good client introducer or developer before Scandinavia. And after those 4 or 5 years in Scandinavia, even this is immodest to say, but I was one of the best client developers after that, because I had good problem-solving skills to begin with, so I combined that with.
And maybe picking up on the problem-solving, the one thing I was curious about as I read the book is you talk about one of the professors in Harvard who chooses not to let you participate in class, who goes on to say that when you speak, the class gets confused. So I was curious to get a sense of what was it about, how you thought about situations which was possibly slightly different from the average B-school student at HBS.
No, it was, if you did, I did mechanical and industrial engineering at IIT Delhi. there are certain class of problems that you get extremely familiar with, like, you know, optimization of a manufacturing line decision theory in terms of risk management and probabilities and so on. So you're very good in math, you're very good analytically, you understand industrial processes and so on. So the professor you're referring to was, you know, a course in production management and manufacturing. It simply was they would try to present a case, and as in any real life situation, there is perhaps a basic way of thinking about it, and then there are more sophisticated ways of thinking about it. You bring some additional principles and complexities that... So he was not trying to teach that complexity. He was trying to teach a basic understanding of, let's say, an optimization problem in a linear programming way, right? And, you know, I understood the limitations of that approach, and I knew the enhancements to that approach. So when there would be some comments, I'd say, yes, this is true in these conditions, but it's not true in here, and you ought to change your approach to X. That's not what he was trying to get through to the class.
Got it. And going back to one of the things you said, Rajat, McKinsey being a place where a lot of CEOs get groomed, in terms of your choices, one of the things I was told when I was going through my journey at McKinsey is every 2 years you need to choose to continue in the firm. I'm sure in your journey, there must have been multiple opportunities to pursue a business leadership role outside of McKinsey. How have you thought about some of those choices if and when they came along your way?
Well, the fact is that I didn't have any per se. And I'll tell you the reason. In my early years, of course, as everybody goes through in the first 6 years, typical time to partnership, 5 leave, right? So it's basically 1 in 6. So you prepare in your mind, you don't know whether you'll be the 1 in 6 or whether you'll be amongst the 5 in 6. And you say, okay, maybe I'll be here till for another year or two or whatever. And then either the firm will ask me to leave or something will happen, because basically it's an up or out meritocratic process. And they're very smart people here. You don't know whether you'll make the cut. And so the first early years were like that. But then after I gained confidence and I was head of Scandinavia, etc., I was quickly got very involved in the leadership of the firm. And I was elected to the board when I was very young. Like I was, 37 years old, which was everybody else on the board was maybe 10 years older than me. So I got involved in the leadership of the firm. I never got an offer from a client that I was serving. And I said, something is wrong. I once asked one or two of my clients, everybody gets an offer, why don't you give me an offer? And he said, well, you're so obviously committed to McKinsey and you're so good at what you do, we never thought we had a chance of getting you. And then I got very involved in the leadership of the firm, and I got managing director when I was 45. So the opportunity did not arise. The opportunity arose when I finished my term as manager. I was 54 when I finished my 3 terms. And I could have done a bunch of things. But I, by that time, was very committed to doing things on the, as I said, beyond the business, social issues, philanthropic activities, trying to make a contribution in global health and in education and so on. And honestly, I felt that the firm gave me a platform that was far better than any other I could have. The firm gave me a lot of freedom after I finished my term to do whatever I pursued, as long as I was making my contribution to client service, which I said, yes, I would. And in my five years or so that I stayed in the firm after, before I retired, and between 54 and 59. You know, I was probably, as I said immodestly, probably one of the most effective client introducers to the firm and developers of client service. So I did that. I did that at part time, basically, because I was devoting a lot of time on. I was chairman of the Global Fund for AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. I was chairman of PHFI and ISB, and I was a chairman of the Gates Foundation Advisory Board. So there was a lot of different roles that had very little to do with McKinsey that I was playing. But because I was an effective client guy, it was very generous of the firm. Said, you know, do whatever you think is right. And those things helped the firm also. It established a great reputation outside.
And one of the things you talk about in the book, Rajat, is how busy you were in that phase. And you talk about that as being one of the things which comes in the way of thoughtfully responding to what showed up along the way.
Yeah.
With the benefit of hindsight, I specifically ask this because in a way, there's a certain tendency to glorify the busy leader that I see. What's been your, how do you look at this notion of how busy should one be with the wisdom of hindsight?
With the wisdom of hindsight, I think you have to be able to say no. I generally say yes. If I can make a contribution and can be helpful to somebody, I generally say yes. And I never took part in anything that I didn't believe I could make a difference. And I could make a difference it was different in different organizations. I spent differential amounts of time in different organizations. But I could make a difference quite effectively with a short amount of input because of the variety of experiences, as well as you can connect the dots in different patterns you see in different places and really be helpful. But they all come also sort of incrementally on one top of, and every one of them makes perfect sense, but collectively they don't make sense. So I got to that stage where when I listed all the things I was doing, I was shocked myself that this was the case.
Got it. And going back to being a strategy consultant, it's often about helping organizations making tough choices or seeing clearly through tough situations where there are trade-offs involved. In your journey, Rajat, as you take stock, what are the choices you're proud of and what are the choices that you wish you'd made differently?
Well, I would say the choices that I'm proud of is actually seeing my role as a business leader in a broader sense and broaden the aperture of that contribution, saying that, you know, business works with the permission of society. It's an obligation we have to help solve some of the most important problems in society. And making an interpretation of that role as a business leader, saying this is also the responsibility of a business leader to become the chairman of the Global Fund for AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis, to take an example. I'm not a public health specialist. I don't know many of the issues that are involved in it, but I have a certain set of skills which are very important in solving those problems. And I bring that expertise combined with other technical expertise that was needed to solve that problem. So you expand, broaden the role. And when you're off from a, you know, kind of a consuming full-time job like being head of McKinsey, then you can do a lot of broader things and make a contribution. So I'm proud of that choice. Now, probably took it to an extreme and did too many things, but by and large, and the impact, if I look at the long-term impact of, let's say, leading McKinsey for 9 years versus creating Public Health Foundation of India, or being a founding board member and chairman of the Global Fund, to creating PHFI and ISB. I don't know which I would pick in terms of lasting impact. I mean, others can judge, but I'm very proud of creating ISB, for example. I mean, it just crossed 10,000 alumni in a short period of time. And those are future business leaders in this country and globally.
And the other side, Rajat, choices that you wish you'd made differently?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that first have to do with sort of learning to say no in certain situations. The other choices is, of course, being much more careful on who you associate with. I generally trusted everybody. And clearly, in this last episode, I should have known better and not trusted some people that I did. I would also say that the very idea of one choice I debate, I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I mean, and I won't say what they are, but I had opportunities that were in the area of making broader social impact, but they would have to be singular. I mean, they were full-time jobs. And they were very meaningful jobs, and I decided not to take them because I thought the portfolio approach of, you know, having a little bit in business. For example, I was I had founded a private equity firm. I only spent, you know, part of my time there. And then I was doing these other things that I've talked about, that a portfolio approach would be more sensible for me at that stage, which I was in around 60, you know. But I'm not sure. I mean, it could have been that I should have, much like as I did in McKinsey and had a singular job, although I did a few other things, but I could have taken the same approach and taken a position that was actually, you know, with a possibility of huge impact, primarily in the social field, and still being able to do a few things. But I didn't do that.
Sure. And a quick comment on trust, Rajat. You spoke about there's enough commentary around what it takes to build trust. In your journey, what have you learned about keeping trust as you go through a roller coaster in the last few years? What have you learned about keeping the trust as you yourself go through on a topsy-turvy journey in terms of how your reputation gets?
You know, I don't think it has much to do with that. My feeling about my general principle of building trust is the first thing that you have to communicate to the other person is that you have their interests at heart. That's the fundamental thing, that you know, you will trust me only if I believe that I have your best interest at heart. Very closely related is you have to believe that I care for your success. I care about you as a person, as to you to be successful. So once you establish that, then you can give very hard messages. You can give, say, very tough things and yet continue on the trust. Most people who trusted me, I trusted because I trusted them, and they in turn returned that trust, you know, lasts very much for a long period of time. Even through some of these difficult times, it still exists, you know, that mutual level of trust. So I think it's all about listening, making sure they understand you're acting in their best interest, caring for their success.
And just as we wrap up, Rajat, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about each individual playing to their his or her unique potential. Summary thoughts to the listeners for them to play to their unique potential. What have you learned through your journey?
Well, I would say one thing I'd say is that, and I make a strong contrast. Don't focus on your career development. Focus very much on your development as a professional, whatever it is, whether you are, you know, a marketing leader or you're just learn to become a consultant or whatever you are. You should learn to focus all your activities and strive to become a better professional. If you will, then automatically career success will follow. Sometimes it may take a zigzag path, but eventually, if you really become an outstanding professional, you will have a great successful career. And if you don't, well, that's kind of destiny. Sometimes that happens too. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I'd say is that get yourself out of your comfort zone. If you get too comfortable in something, you're not realizing your full potential. You've maximized on the learning there, and you have to do something different. And I, in my own personal career, changed every few years. Whether you change your geographic location, or I got a new assignment, or something happened that forced me into getting me out of my comfort zone. I left Scandinavia. I did speak when, you know, you say, why are you leaving? I mean, you know, I just said, I'm too comfortable. I mean, everything is hunky-dory and great, but I'm not learning anything more. And so that I would say is, I mean, I could go on and on.
But Rajat, pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
In one of the media events around the book, somebody asked him what Rajat wanted to accomplish by writing this book. He said he wanted to share his journey with the world at large, and people could absorb whatever they wanted to through osmosis, as he mentions earlier in this conversation. In a way, this captures the spirit behind this podcast series. While I go about talking to a range of people, I recognize that different segments of the conversation will appeal to different people, and what you might take away might be very different from what someone else takes away. I try not to break it down to 7 rules of success or 13 things you need to know to become a CEO or something like that. Life, I feel, is a little too nuanced for that kind of analysis. If you find the podcast series purposeful, do subscribe at playtopotential.com and share it with the people that you think would benefit from the content. Do take a moment to rate and review on iTunes or any other platform where you consume this content. It will help others discover it. Thank you for listening. Bye now.